lineouts, racks.
Pulls, engage!
What an amazing try!
Tries and tackles, dissected by South Africa's top rugby minds.
That is world class!
This is To The Last Drop, your weekly in-depth rugby podcast with Liam Delcombe and Brendan Nell.
This is To The Last Drop. I'm Brendan Nell.
And I'm Liam Delcombe.
This week, we're in Cape Town, and it's ahead of the epic second test between the Springboks and the All Blacks. We had a sit-down with our good friend, author, and Radio New Zealand journalist, Jamie Wall. And we chatted about the All Blacks, the Springboks, and a lot of other news coming out this week about two sides. So have a listen and enjoy. Well, welcome back. We're sitting in one of the nicest hotel rooms in Cape Town. Very close to the Springboks.
I don't know about a hotel room. It feels more like an apartment.
It does.
Well, welcome to my house.
Sweet. Sweet, in fact.
With our guest today is Jamie Wall, who's written this wonderful book about the All Blacks and Springboks. If you can find it, where do you find it, Joe?
You can find it online. If you just Google me, you can either go to my website or Allen and Unwin, the publishers, and hopefully they'll be able to send one out for you.
Yeah.
And that's Jamie, I-E, and then insert him W-A-L-L.
That's right.
So, yeah, we've been Cape Town. It's ahead of the second test. We had an epic first game at Ellis Park. And looking forward to the second one. The weather's not quite as great as Joburg. But, Jamie, how are you enjoying Cape Town?
Oh, it's great. Yeah, I love it. It's obviously a beautiful place. We're at the foot of the mountain here. And to be able to, we walked out and sort of walked away from it the first day we were here and then realised and turned around and it was sort of appeared to us right there because we flew it at night. So it was a very dramatic introduction to Table Mountain. And so it was a beautiful day, so we went up it, and it's pretty stunning. One of the most beautiful views I've ever seen.
How difficult was it to, when you get to the reception, you say, I want to see you at the mountain?
I didn't get to choose, unfortunately, but as you can see, I've landed on my feet. And
The Aperam balcony is actually, it's a win.
Yeah, well, there are very few places in Cape Town that don't have a good view either way. So, let's start with Ellis Park. I think there was so much in that game. The All Blacks, the box weren't very clinical in that first part. The All Blacks handled the game exceptionally well for the first 60, and then sort of fell apart in the last 20. And you asked a very pointed question to Scott Robertson afterwards about this not being the first time that they haven't scored in the last 20. How big of a factor do you think that is?
Well, it was the difference between winning and losing on Saturday. It was almost the difference between winning and losing in both tests against England that they played earlier this year. And I think that it's something that they really need to fix. It's the most obvious thing they need to fix, is that they're fading at the end of games. And they're playing against the team right now who is the complete opposite. You know, they're a team that's built their identity around a bunch of guys coming on and closing the game out. And it's something that I don't think the All Blacks are quite there with. I will say something, though, in Scott Robertson's defence on this, is that the thing about the bomb squad is that it's based on experience. You're bringing on a guy like Marks, who's played how many tests? 70-something tests. Yeah. Pollard, who's played how many, he's been playing for 10 years.
It's a bit,
it's 120. He's most capped Springbok of all time, or he will be in a couple of games or something. So that's what the bomb squad's based on, is that these guys have been there and done it before. The All Blacks can't do that. They can't invent experience. They can't manufacture what the bomb squad brings on. And so I think it's something that they're going to have to figure out a way of doing, perhaps moving some of their more experienced players back into a bench role, really looking at what Russ has done with the bomb squad, how he's essentially just developed two forward packs. So I guess in a long-winded way that That's why I asked the question and why I want to know, are we just going to see a continuation of the last 4 years from the All Blacks where it was a definition of insanity, which was we're just going to try the same thing over and over again and expect different results.
Was that the fourth game in a row where that happened?
It was the third game of the season, and the other game, the first test against England, they only kicked a penalty.
Okay.
In the last 20 minutes.
And for you, I mean, is it purely personnel, or is there mindset? Is mindset also potentially an issue?
It's a bit of both, I think. And it goes back to the experience that I talked about. To bring a guy off the bench who's never been in that position. Because you've got to remember, like, because I think we're finding out right now what not being in Super Rugby is doing to the All Blacks, because you had about half a dozen guys who not only had never played at altitude before, but never even been to South Africa before. Mm. You know, this is their first time in the country. And while it's cool and it's a nice story, it means that you just don't, you know, if you come here for Super Rugby, coming with the Chiefs or the Highlanders or whoever, and you'd got a taste of it, it clearly made a difference over that, 20-odd years, that it was just a regular thing.
Yeah.
And teams learn how to handle it at altitude. We're seeing that more and more now with the URC, especially the Irish teams and the Scottish teams, learning how to handle the altitude when they come up here.
But you're doing very well, actually.
Yeah, and it, the regular travelling does a thing. And I mean, the Super Rugby argument is something that goes around it quite a bit. And I think anybody who loves New Zealand and South African rugby misses that part of it. Maybe not miss the other part of it too much, of the Wallaby, the Aussie derbies so much. We don't get too excited about those, but just the regular contact. But and we'll get to that now, because there's been some news this week about tourism and stuff like that. Mm. At this park, I just sort of wondered, you talk about experience.
Mm.
Part of what the box have got right, though, I suppose, is the fact that they choose from everywhere in the world. And it's becoming less of it. Was a thing when Rusty took over a lot more. I think as we're getting on, it's becoming less of a factor now, and there's more players returning home and not so many being picked from overseas. There's still a fair chunk, and they keep them obviously well wrapped in the Japanese league and things like that. But how much has that hurt New Zealand rugby? The Aaron Smiths, the Richie Mongers, those guys sort of leaving, because that's the guys you'd want to bring on.
It's a complicated one, because I mean, I personally agree with the way that NZ Rugby goes about it, because given where we are geographically and the narrative of players leaving when they feel their All Black career is over, it's been like that since 1996. And there are very, very real fears that if they just open the doors, everyone will leave. And if you take all of those players out of Super Rugby, it would destroy it as a competition, and therefore it would destroy the production line for the All Blacks. On the other hand, things are changing. You know, they are. South Africa have shown that it can work. I mean, obviously, because you've won two World Cups with that rule in place, and that perhaps it needs to be looked at. And it took until Malanga going overseas at, you know, sort of in his prime, and now he's seen as kind of the answer to the problems that the All Blacks have. Not that I think there's a massive problem, you know, because losing the Springboks at Ellis Park is no shame. But it just sort of feels like if DMAC doesn't become this, you know, like a solid starting 10 that, you know, you're trusting in, and that he's sort of one of the first names on the team sheet, then there's always going to be this narrative underlying about Moana coming back. And to be perfectly honest, I think what it's, instead of what changing the rules, they'll just make more of an effort to get him back into New Zealand, because it's going to benefit, I mean, I presume he'd go back to the Crusaders, and it'll benefit them, because do they need all help they can get right now? And it'll help New Zealand rugby, because having him there is going to make everyone around him a better player as well. And sending him overseas is just going to do that for another country. And I think that's the thinking behind why the players, they don't want players leaving.
You mentioned McKenzie, and there's been a lot of chat about him. Do you think some of it is unfair? Because it's almost as if, unless he's a superstar, nothing below that is going to be good enough.
Yeah, he's an interesting sort of story, because I think he falls into the kind of Carlos Spencer mold of a guy who I don't think the majority of the New Zealand public is ever going to like 100% trust, because his game plan is based on off-the-cuff play and just pulling something out in order to win. And, you know, I think he's a great player, but he kind of needs someone else in the back line to steady things, whereas we just got so used to having a, like Dan Carter in there. And you've got to remember that Mwanga was under a serious amount of scrutiny when he started as well, that people were saying that he was a very, very good Super Rugby player, but clearly not test capable. And then by the time he finished, you know, he was, like you said, how could you possibly let this guy go?
Yeah.
So I think that time is on the next side. Scott Robertson has really telegraphed the fact that he has faith in him and he's going to keep trusting him, like, for this season. And then so by the end of the season, if he can just continue on and play consistently well to the end, we'll have the clear, you know, the usual New Zealand rugby situation of, well, who was Richard Mwanga? You know, like, what have you done for me lately? Because we've got this guy now.
And it's just strange, though, is how that works. And I mean, I think of myself, if you look at 2015, the difference between that exceptional, well, they were a really good team anyway, dominating between the World Cups. But that semi-final, there was one penalty that was overturned against the Springboks at a crucial time. And Dan got the one, and that was the difference between the World Cup. And Saturday again, I mean, there was one yellow card that made the difference, and the boxer took advantage of that. So a lot of these times, I sometimes feel that, you know, fans, well, I suppose we all get it at times, fans are very unfair times with the players. And they're exceptional players. It's just sometimes, with coaches, we always say that sometimes just the environment's not right. Eddie Jones is a good example. Some places he's a genius, some places he's the villain, because just some things just don't work. Looking at Scott Robertson, yeah, he's coming with a hell of a CV in Super Rugby. And not to even mention his breakdancing skills. It's a pity breakdancing's not at the Olympics again now, because I think he could have probably...
Yeah, officially been there.
Well, I don't know. Okay. That's what we hear. So, I think the Aussies probably broke it somehow. So, but the expectation of him, especially after a lot of time sitting here in South Africa, we felt that... Ian Foster's greatest sin was the fact that he was Steve Hansen's assistant.
Yeah.
And he was never a bad coach, but just that sort of automatic hatred towards him that started. And in a time where the All Blacks were also struggling, where Scott Robinson's had almost the opposite, that people have thought he's going to come in and just turn things around. And probably he's finding that it's not that easy. And I just want to go back to something Heinicke May always used to say, is that, I mean, he was exceptionally successful at Super Rugby as well. And the first thing he said it was the worst shock for him going into international rugby, where you have a week to prepare a team, you have no control of your players the rest of the season, and you've got, 12 weeks a year to just find that success. And I just wonder if that's maybe not catching Scott as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think that he's definitely learning on the job, and that it's probably not as smooth a ride as we all kind of thought or hoped it was going to be. And I think that you can probably, if you watch some of the media appearances leading up to and then sort of after the first test and now leading up to now, that it's taking him a while to be comfortable with that part of the job as well, because, you know, it's the most high-profile job in New Zealand next to the Prime Minister, really. And he has to be the main character of the All Blacks, because that's just the way it is now with coaches. Like, we deal with big personality coaches now, and they have to be fronting, they have to be explaining, and I don't think he had to do that much at the Crusaders, because of course they won all the time. And so to be asked questions of like, well, why aren't you winning, you know, what the hell happened in Wellington against Argentina, it was a new kind of concept for him. It's not something that he's used to. And so I think it's fair to assume, from what we can see about the learning on the job, that there's a lot of that going on with what we don't see as well. And you're absolutely right about preparing a team, only being given a week to prepare. But yes, there is a bit of overreach into Super Rugby about, you know, pulling players out, and obviously they're in constant contact, a lot more so than they used to be in the old days. But yeah, it's not like you've got them for a whole summer pre-season and building your shape and doing everything before, and you're doing months worth of prep before you even play a game.
Yeah.
It's not like that. It's like test rugby is literally the deep end. And while he's treading water right now, he needs to start learning to swim.
Yeah, it probably also begs the question, if you can have a new coach and he comes from a competition background, where it's signing and campus or whatever, that the people around him become important. Are you comfortable that he's surrounded by people who can
navigate
these waters?
I mean, that's like a massive talking point because he just got rid of one of them the other week.
Your old mate.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's an interesting story that I think we're going to hear both sides of it at some stage, but it's not going to be for a while. So we're left to kind of guess as to what happened. But I mean, I think from what I can kind of understand of the situation is that there's a lot of assistants, like more assistants than there were before, and they've kind of been given this season to audition for the role of being the right-hand man, the way Foster was for Hansen, the way Hansen was for Henry, and therefore become the successor. Mm-hmm. If you know what I mean, because you can, instead of setting yourself up for 4 years, you're setting yourself up for like the next potentially 12. And they obviously all want that gig. And I think that McDonald probably thought he already had it because he was the guy who was connected with Robertson right from the start in terms of a coaching ticket. And to get in a situation and find that there's, you know, four other guys who are just as hungry as he is to be in that position. Probably came as a bit of a shock. I mean, this is my take on it. This is my opinion. But I think that if you're going to pick a bunch of guys who are all head coaches and then make them assistants, it's going to create a lot of tension. Mm-hmm. And that's not an entirely bad thing, mm-hmm. you know, because it's going to make you push each other to perform. But you need to get that chemistry right, those personalities right, in order for everything to be sort of moving in the same direction.
So what would be considered success for Scott over the, I suppose, World Cup's going to be the ultimate thing that he's going to be judged on, but over the next sort of 12, 18 months?
I mean, well, base level is retain the Blues League Cup because you don't want to be the first guy to lose that in, was it 22 years? Yeah. So, I mean, that's probably the most important thing this year, because if that goes, then we're going to have to ask some really serious questions. I think that the record against, or like playing the Springboks here, like people obviously, because of the rivalry, because of the relationship between two countries, it's like there's no shame in losing to the Springboks at Ellis Park. Cape Town, because of where it is, like I think there's probably an expectation the All Blacks are going to win here. Because it's like kind of seen as a home game for them. But again, like the Springboks aren't world champions by accident. They're a very, very good team. I think that the India tour is going to be quite crucial because you've got these three very tough tests in a row against England, Ireland and France. So you're playing all the next best teams this year, and it's when you stack up that record at the end of the year and go, okay, well, anything more than like two losses in an All Black season comes under scrutiny. And there's potentially another sort of two or three to come. So we're going to look back on this season and go, do we need to admit this is a rebuild?
Yeah.
You know, that this...
I was about to ask, in terms of rebuilding, I mean, do you get a sense that there's a rebuild or has he reverted to a lot of the Foster players? Because obviously if it's a new squad, if he's building, then people will cut him more slack.
Yes, but yes and no. Yeah. Because it's the All Blacks and they are expected to win every single game. And I think you can probably get away with doing a rebuild, but you can't ever admit it.
Yeah.
And I think that what he's done, how he's got around that is by doing it incrementally. That he didn't just come in and just blow everything up and start again. He essentially picked the same team as last year, and the only guys that he replaced were either injured or they'd moved overseas. So he started the year with Foster's team, and he's sort of slowly kind of moving it into his own team, and he's using all the guys he knows. You know, there's obviously a massive Crusaders influence in there at the moment. Like, I think for the Rugby Championship, there's more Crusaders in the squad than any other team, which is kind of weird considering that they missed the playoffs. But then all of his staff as well, you know, heavy Crusaders influence. And, like, I get it, you know. Like, why wouldn't you bring in people that you know and you trust?
Speaking of big ball carriers, I mean, you mention that now. Dalton Papali, is he properly in the mix for Saturday?
Yes.
Because, and does he solve some of the problems from last week?
That's a really good question, because like what do you do with him? Because he was obviously a starter. And he comes into the squad, whether he starts in front of Kane, because I thought Kane had a really good game. And he did what the All Blacks have kind of been lacking, which is having a loose forward mix with one guy purely there to do the dirty work, you know, to get over the ball, hit people, hurt people, you know.
Which he did.
Which, yeah, it depends. but you know, to do that stuff so Artie can, you know, get the ball in his hands. The problem is that Artie can't do it all by himself. And so Dalton is a good, you know, ball carrier. Like, he's a good all-round player. Does he solve that issue? I don't think so. He's more of a guy that would come on and take workload off Kane. So it'll be really interesting to see what they do with the loose forwards this week. Because, like I said, Kane was brought in because he's experienced, because he's physical, because he hurts people. And I feel like they're going to need that on Saturday. Because this is a test that's probably going to be won just by pushing it to the absolute closest to the line as they can. Because there's going to be a lot of scrutiny on the referees, obviously, after what happened on Saturday. So it's who can get away with.
And I suppose also what we spoke about earlier, the bench and potentially getting experience. I mean, it could be the guy.
Exactly.
I was going to ask you, I think one thing I always find interesting is and it's a question I'm sure you've probably been asked while you're here. What is the Kiwi view on Rossi all round? And I mean, obviously, he's a 2 World Cups, great coach. That goes without saying. But bit of a maverick, and very interesting character if you're not from South Africa.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's an interesting character no matter where you're from. I think that the New Zealand view is that he's your version of Scott Robertson. He's a guy who just clearly thinks outside the box, and he you know, uses his personality to be the personality of the team that he's in charge of. I mean, I think he's very well respected, like, as a coach in New Zealand, because you can't argue with his record. He is seen as, I guess, probably a little bit sort of cunning, calculated in the way and things he says, and you know, he's the only coach that uses social media as well, which is really interesting for us. So it's all
strategically as well.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's all about reading between the lines. So I mean, I love that side of it, you know, because he sort of, every time he tweets, he sort of, oh, what does he mean? is he talking about us? You know? But I think on the general view, like, obviously there's been some controversy this week about stuff that's been said. But yeah, like, if you're a winner, you're going to get respected in New Zealand, no matter where you're from. You know, Australian, English, Irish, whatever. If you've got the gold, then you're going to get the plaudits from New Zealanders, because that's the one currency that we trade in as success.
And as, of course, if you look at the rivalry, he's kind of the guy who's helped restore it, because it was going one way. And then he...
Absolutely. And it goes, I mean, also, there's this great narrative of him and Robertson who played against each other. You know, they're roughly the same age, and you know, they were the same sort of type of player, even. There's a lot of similarities between the two. And now they're in charge of these two teams that both, you know, New Zealand rugby, South rugby, and like fans all around the world. And it's really, really just come to the surface in this last couple of weeks. It's been fantastic being here for it, is that people really want this to be the biggest thing in rugby again, like it was back in the day, where this was seen as the World Heavyweight Championship of rugby. And, you know, it was the World Cup before there was a World Cup. And people want that again, and they want the tours, and they want this to be the game at Eden Park, because it hasn't been for a long time, because NZ Rugby have been like, well, no, the Bledisloe always fills it up. So, no, this is the one. We're going to put that record on the line against the best team in the world.
But like the WBA, WBC, and then the IBF.
Yeah, unifying the titles.
There might be some Irish people who disagree with you, Liam.
it's a championship.
Let's touch on the tours quickly. I mean, obviously, that's the big news this week. Liam and I sort of chuckle about it, because we did write the story almost a year ago, when there was still probably not so much detail at that stage. but we had a very frank discussion before the World Cup with Mark Alexander, where he sort of admitted this was on the table. And we were very excited back then. But just the prospect of an old school tour, I've been lucky enough to do a couple of Lions tours, so has them. We've been lucky. I was lucky enough. And I think you were also there in the 96 All Black tour.
No, I was coming to take a tour.
Okay, but the 96 All Black tour was one of the best I've ever done as well. Yeah. And we've all grown up with these tours where they used to have so many sort of just subplots along the way, dirt trackers and things like that. So hopefully we're going to get to the same thing. And I mean, there's a lot of excitement here about it. And I take in New Zealand the same.
Yeah, absolutely there is. I mean, I'll say one thing, it's going to be more fun than the last tour that came in here for a start. And I think the cool thing about it right now is that it's clearly on the cards. Like, we just need someone to officially say it. And Mark Robinson, the CEO of New Zealand Rugby, is in the country right now. And we're like, well, are you making an announcement this week? You know, are you going to just come out with Rian Oberholzer and just say, like, yep, in 2 years, it's all go. And then we can start figuring out, like, well, what's the best schedule? Who are they going to play? And, you know, how many players are they going to bring? And how's it all going to work? And how many New Zealand fans are going to come over for it? Because I think what the most exciting thing for us is that we obviously have inbound tours and we have Lions tours and you have all these thousands of British fans come over, and it's great. And now we can do the same thing, because the only tours the All Blacks, you know, go on are the, you know, the end of year tours, and it's, you know, just a bit too far to go. And it's like it happens every year, and you know, it's like they're great. Like, don't get me wrong, like, it's fantastic going to Twickenham and Murrayfield and Millennium and Aviva and Paris and that. But this hasn't happened in, you know, 3 decades. And it has that old school, and you say old school, but it literally is, because this is how long you'd have to wait back in the, it wasn't that long, but it was, you know, you'd have to wait like a decade before it happened again. So it's that anticipation, it's that build up, and we talk about, you know, use the boxing analogy, it's like that's why they announce a fight like you know, 8 months before it happens, because you've got 8 months to build it up and make sure everybody's watching it.
I think one of the stumbling blocks, but the, why they haven't announced it, had to do with the revenue split, because that's needed to be thrashed.
Well, there's also the why, what do they do with the rugby championship? Like, because that to us, because obviously this is nothing new for us as well. We've been talking about, like, I'll bring back tours and, you know, do it that way. But and then it always gets told to us, like, well, how are you going to play the rugby championship if we do that? So it would need, they would probably need to cut the end of year tour, if that was the case, and do it like they did in 96 by tacking it onto the end of an already tough season.
So, I heard that New Zealand wasn't that keen to have the rugby championship. I think it's more in favour of a single round truncated one.
Yeah, well, I'm, you know, they all had won it 95% of the time, maybe.
Yeah.
Just give it a rest for you.
Well, I think the thing is it tends to be, and it's unfortunately evolved that way over the last 2 decades, is that it's basically a contest between, is South Africa, New Zealand win it most of the time, but is South Africa competitive? That's the only time it becomes a competitive championship. I mean, I think Australia won it once in the entire, maybe. Yeah. But I mean, very rarely is an Australian team in the running for.
It basically just comes down to the World Cup years, because the schedule's reduced, and so therefore... It comes out who plays who where. And that's why I think it was 2011, 2015 and 2019 the All Blacks actually lost. But that's when the All Blacks lost, because they had to play their tough games away from home. And they had their eye on what was happening later in the year anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a little bit of I don't think we want to lose contact totally with Australia and Argentina, but the rugby champion certainly needs some bit of a rethink in some way. But partly from our point of view, because of a different point of view, because now we're playing in the north and we've got this 12-month season, which is not sustainable for anybody as we go on. But I think we all want the old school tours. We all want something with a bit of a narrative around.
It just cracks me up, because when you look at rugby as a sport, and that, you know, for all the issues that it has administration-wise and, like, you know, trying to get a global season going, that the answer to the problem is just to literally go back to the way that they did it for about 100 years, which worked perfectly.
There's so much to be said for a player who is coming through, a young player, gets picked for the national team, go on to a... You may not have a passage into the test team immediately, but you can play your way in.
Yeah,
first test that out, you're there.
But that's the thing. And I mean, and we got to this era and they started making the squads bigger and bigger and bigger. And then the lines too with almost 50 players. And so you don't get that anymore where a guy in the dirt track is, the so-called old dirt track is actually in there, injury comes and he gets his break and the tours like that. You know, those narratives be great if they're back again.
Yeah, of course they would be. And, you know, we're all talking about it as people who grew up around tours. I would be interested to know what younger generations of fans think about it, because they are the important ones. They're the ones who have to grow up and, you know, become people who are spending money on the game and engaging with the game on a weekly basis like we are. Like, you know, really, we're the ones that don't matter at all. Because we're gonna watch it no matter what.
Yeah, that's true.
And so to sell this kind of concept, so the one good thing about taking those tours and everything away for so long is that you can introduce them to a new audience as something new. Whereas for us, it's old. So that's kind of cool. The only kind of drawback I see to it, because it's, you know, while we're all really happy and excited about it, there is at least one drawback that I can think of, and it's the same problem that the Six Nations has, is that we're going to create something that we're going to hold sort of higher than everything else, and we're going to shut out everybody else out of it. And you talk about Australia and Argentina, like, you guys have a different view of Australia because you're like, what's the point? For us, Australia is incredibly important. Yeah. Like, we have to, there would be nothing better than if the Wallabies got good again.
Yeah,
But I mean, the Blues look up already somehow, it's still like, a massive draw in New Zealand. Like, it fills up Eden Park every time they play, even though everyone knows what's going to happen. But I think that's just New Zealand culture, because people just want to see New Zealand beating Australia.
Well, I think if cricket's taught us anything, and the test cricket is that you can't have three or four nations just controlling everything.
Yeah, exactly.
They're just going to kill the game eventually. So 100% that point. But that's what these guys have to figure out. I don't think it's a reason not to do the tours.
Yeah, absolutely not. But I think that just the issue with the Six Nations at the moment is, like, my view is that, yes, it's great, and yes, they fill up these massive stadiums and the tradition is there, and it's, but it's as long as they're never going to think any bigger than that. Yeah. They're never going to bring Georgia in or something, because the people who are creaming off the top on that one are very happy with the way it is, and they don't want to share it with anyone else. And I don't want to see SA rugby and NZ rugby fall into that position where it's like, we're sweet. We're going to shut the door on anyone else.
Different side of the same coin, South Africa and New Zealand will argue they've taken knocks financially over the last number of years.
Right.
Being in a competition where Australia and Argentina maybe don't bring the numbers. But I mean, that's just a...
Just to finish it on that point, though, is that I think that if the recent visit by Argentina taught us anything, is that fans need to get on board with the fact that they're a good team. You know, they are consistently a good team. The problem is that for about 20 years, they saved their worst efforts against the All Blacks. And so whenever All Blacks would see the Pumas, that's their side that gave up after about 15 minutes. And there was about a run of... When they came into the Rugby Championship, it took until about 2018... before they even had what could be called like an entertaining game against the All Blacks. And I think that mindset of New Zealanders, you know, because the Pumas have come to New Zealand now twice and won. They're actually really... that's a very successful record in, what's that, like who else has come to New Zealand won twice in 3 years?
Yeah, I don't think the Box have even. The Box have drawn one and won one.
Yeah.
So, I can't let you go, Jamie. My last question for the pod...
Sure.
And it's the one you know I was going to ask you, because it's the one that keeps Twitter busy every now and again. It's the elephant in the room, but let's address it, because somebody on Twitter will ask me, why didn't I ask that question? Are you Ben Smith?
No, I'm not. I'm not, Brendan. I'm not. I've been over this. I was lucky enough to go to a braai last night at the foot of Devil's Peak. with Mark Keohane and his family and his son Ollie. Brought a few friends around, and every single one asked me that question. And I said, I didn't realize it was actually that big a thing. I thought it was just some weirdos on Twitter that asked, but no, I'm not. I can tell you, I can give you some context around if you like.
Yeah, good.
So I know Ben. I've known Ben for a long time. We're from the same place. We're from Wellington in New Zealand. And I actually started out working at Rugby Post. That was my first proper gig covering rugby. And Ben was running a very successful YouTube channel at the time. And I sort of recruited him and got him under the nose of the boss of Rugby Pass and said, this guy he's really good at what he does. But he was a video guy. He got into writing and that. I left Rugby Pass in that year, ironically, because I didn't like the editorial direction they were taking, which was to piss South Africans off. At the time, because
just the
they found
to do
exactly because they no because they found
we're all very calm people.
Yeah. But this was back when Facebook comments was sort of a really key metric, and they found that every time that they'd sort of say anything about the Springboks,
yes.
And I wasn't a big fan of that sort of thing. I didn't want to do that with my work, and so I just finished my contract and moved on to Radio New Zealand.
But somebody else though.
But Ben sort of picked up where I left off. So there is like a slight connection there, but I think it all started for Ben after the 2019 World Cup, where he wrote something that I think a lot of people in New Zealand actually, do agree with, which is that the All Blacks did the Springboks the biggest favour by beating them in the first game, because it sent them to the other side of the draw. And I think even the most one-eyed South African fan can say, like, well, if you're going to play Japan, like the most injured Welsh team ever, and then an English team that have played their final the week before, it's probably the easiest run that anyone's had to win a World Cup. Not taking anything away from the feat, and because I was there, it was a fantastic moment and everything. And, he wrote it with, conviction. He wasn't just trying to piss anyone off. He was just pointing out. Like,
there's very little doubt that defeat sharpened focus in boxing.
Yeah.
And although, it also helped get the season.
Although, and I know Jake won't like me saying this, but I think 2007 was probably easier. Fiji, Argentina, and then England in the final. So,
fair. Yeah, but in any way, it all sort of blew up from there.
Yeah.
And then people started to know by name, and then he just sort of ran with it. And I mean, honestly, I'm just going to tell you the same thing I've told everybody else who's asked me. If you don't like him, stop reacting to what he does. Because for cool, everything he says just gets a whole bunch of reactions. I've gone in a different route on this trip. Maybe you might have noticed my Twitter.
You've embraced the brand.
I've tried to ingratiate myself into South African culture. So if you've noticed that, like, that's for real. I'm not putting it on. This is not a joke or anything. I've really enjoyed my time in South Africa. It's my first time here. It's the last place that I've been with the All Blacks visit, and I'm glad I've saved this till last, because it's a rugby country. The people just are fantastic, and the game I attended at Ellis Park was just like phenomenal. So everything I'm saying on Twitter, it's true. Like, that's how I feel about this place.
Well, I think somebody's talked yourself into a snook and chips for lunch. That's a real...
I thought we had to throw that one in, because somebody's got Twitter's going to ask us. Thanks for joining us. Sorry, there's a friend. Anyway, that has been great. And let's hope that the game lives up to the hype this Saturday.
Yeah, I'm sure it will.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. For the latest insights and rugby analysis each week, plus new episode alerts, please follow or subscribe to the series. Or find all episodes at jacarandafm.com or the Jackpot app.